To GR2, what you've just been given out is a copy of chapters 1 to 3, so it's already quite a chunky set of notes. I think it's going to take us about 2 or 3 lectures to get to the end of chapter 3, maybe even more, could be as many as 4 lectures. I don't want to go too fast. What I think I can at least do, however, is not spend very long on chapter 1, so let me explain the function of chapter 1. So the first couple of pages of your notes, I've just got the PDF up on the screen as well, so you can look at the screen or you can look at the notes, whichever you prefer. The first couple of pages are just welcome info and just a couple of comments about books which are worth consulting. I know that Norman is generally taking the view that the more books you read in this topic, the better, time permitting, because it gives you a variety of views, a variety of ways of thinking about what are very abstract ideas. But the one that I would recommend above all is Bernard Schutz's book, which I've often referred to as just Green Shoots Through the Notes, A First Course in General Relativity. Does anybody have that one? Did anyone buy it? A couple of people have. Okay, that's good. There's copies available elsewhere. There's a copy in the library, I think. There's one in the Astrosoc and Physsoc library, and there's also one at the observatory. I should stress, however, that I've written these notes with the kind of intention that, you know, they do stand alone without you really needing to look at a textbook. I can't emphasise enough, as Norman has said, the usefulness of consulting some books, but it's by no means essential. I mean, if all you ever do is read these notes and understand them really thoroughly, then you'll do just fine. And that is, you know, not just a desire to help you save money, but also it's recognising that depending on what you go on to do, this could be a kind of resource that you could use later as well. For example, many of the students who do PhDs in the IGR, Institute for Gravitational Research, as they approach the time of writing up their thesis and they've got to do a review chapter on GR, the number of times that people come and ask me for copies of the GR course that you're about to embark on is quite considerable. Incidentally, anyone any idea why there's a razor in the front here? I'm hoping that no one will have to slash their wrist by the end of the course, the least of all me, but it looks as if that's been left there from earlier. John Brown hasn't shaved off his beard or anything, has he? No? Okay. Right, so after the kind of welcome stuff, I should just mention also, as you can see for yourself, I've made a comment about the metric signature that we're going to use throughout GR2, which is to put the minus sign on the time variable, the time coordinate, and plus signs on X, Y, and Z. The first time I taught this course, Norman had taught the first half, and he had adopted the metric signature the other way around. And I thought it was worth just pointing out that I hadn't adopted this signature to be deliberately unhelpful. It was just that when I had taught the second year course on special and general relativity, I'd done the metric this way round, and that I was being consistent with my own previous notes, and I wanted to sort of apologise for it being different from Norman. And then Norman and I got together and we said, okay, we must fix this, we'll change it for the next time. And what happened was, in 2005, I then changed to plus minus minus minus, and Norman changed to minus plus plus plus, but fortunately we have converged on, I think, agreement now. But I guess the main point is that even if we were using a different form for the metric, remember, you know, above all, what we ought to take from a course like this one is that you shouldn't be scared by the maths and by all the symbols. It's hard not to be intimidated by it all at first. But what hopefully should emerge from your developing understanding of this topic is that these are just labels anyway, and that what GR is fundamentally concerned with is identifying sort of physically meaningful things that we express using the complicated mathematical machinery that Norman's been developing. And actually, we'll see, for example, a wee bit later in the course, we'll see when we get on to talking about black holes, that inside the event horizon of a black hole, the behaviour of the metric flips over anyway, and what was previously time-like intervals become space-like, and what were space-like become time-like. All part of the weird and wonderful behaviour of space-time in the region of a black hole. So we'll get to that much later. So first chapter is a sort of resume of GRG part one. I'm not going to go through that. I can strongly recommend that you have a read of it for two reasons. A, it's shorter than reading all your way through Norman's entire lecture notes. B, in fact, I'm going to be like the Spanish Inquisition here for three reasons, because B, I think it's also my attempt to extract from what was covered in Norman's syllabus the really important things that you need to know. And then thirdly, maybe most importantly, it's a way to let you see the kind of notation that I have used in the past teaching GRG1. And it's not that it's really different fundamentally from what Norman's done, but a lot of the time what I've done is I've used coordinate notation. That means that I've written expressions explicitly in terms of indices to denote different coordinates. Whereas Norman, you know, in the way that he would define things like one forms or contravariant vectors or geodesics, he would write the geodesic equation, or covariant differentiation, generally I think is favoured using coordinate-free notation. Now the reason why I've generally gone for coordinates is that this is the applied half of the course, so you're going to have to actually take the equations developed in Norman's half and work out stuff for particular choices of coordinate system, like polar coordinates or Cartesians. So my resume of the first half is using coordinates really from the word go. But that's kind of all. I think otherwise you should recognise a great deal in Chapter 1 from Norman's notes. I certainly hope you do, if you've not had the chance to sort of totally get your head around Norman's half yet, then, you know, don't despair, there's still a few months to the exam, and hopefully my half will help to reinforce many of the ideas from Norman's half anyway. So what we'll get on to in just a couple of minutes is a discussion of Chapter 2, Static Models with Spherical Symmetry, because wherever we can, we're going to simplify life by considering spherically symmetric solutions to Einstein's equations, and that's no different from what Einstein himself did. We'll look at some of the simplifications that that brings about. And that will lead on to the discussion of one particular spherically symmetric model, which is the Schwarzschild metric. It's a metric which is static, that means it's the components of the metric are not changing in time. And it's an idealization, but it's a remarkably good one, and it's perfectly applicable to our own solar system, for example. And therefore, among the classical tests of general relativity are the Schwarzschild metric applied to the sun and the planets, or the other very famous one is the deflection of light as it passes close to the sun, which was the experiment carried out by Arthur Eddington to verify the correctness of GR. Did anyone see the programme on telly about Eddington and Einstein with David Tennant as Arthur Eddington? I don't know how scientifically accurate it was in some places, but I still thought it was quite good. So more on that in lectures to come. Chapter 4 is, instead of looking at the metric exterior to a star, it looks at the interior structure of a star. So I know we have a few people here who are not doing physics and astronomy. How many folks are doing theoretical physics, for example? We got anyone? Yeah, okay. I know that there's not a large cohort, but we've got at least one person. And then have we got some folks doing single physics but doing this as an option? Yeah, okay. Chapter 4, and I guess to some extent Chapter 3, are the ones which draw most upon ideas from the mains of classical astronomical theory, but not very much, and I'll make absolutely sure that I don't assume too much, that you know that you come here with 3 years of astronomy behind you. Just out of interest, have any of you done Astronomy 1, for example, or XCOS? Yeah, I thought I recognised the face. Right, okay. Well, as I say, I have been careful in teaching this for the last few years to make sure that I don't assume too much by way of astronomy. And that's especially important in Chapter 4. And the main result in Chapter 4 is to look at how the structure of a star differs from what you would predict in sort of classical physics, where you derive the interior structure of a star using ideas of hydrostatic equilibrium. And there's an equation for hydrostatic equilibrium, which, say, the astros have met, maybe you have as well in other physics courses, but the GR version of that equation looks different and leads to some quite interesting consequences. Chapter 5 on gravitational waves. Well, we'll see how we do in terms of time. There's a lot of material in that chapter, but I may not cover all of it, and I'll be very clear to point out what's examinable and what isn't in those terms. But the reason why it might not make much sense to cover it all is that we now run a graduate lecture course in gravitational wave detection as part of the SUPA graduate school. And I was teaching that just this morning, actually. So much of the material in Chapter 5 overlaps with that graduate course. So those of you who would go on, as some of you might well, to work in that area would have a chance to take it as graduates. And those who don't, well, you're probably not going to be too disappointed if we don't cover it all anyway. But there's a couple of key results from Chapter 5 which I will go through, but not all the gory details. And the main reason I want to do that is to free up a bit more time than there's been in previous years to cover Chapter 6 and 7, because black holes and cosmology are both very appropriate areas to apply GR, but they're also the kind of things that I suppose most people think of that GR is relevant for and interesting with regard to. So we'll look at Schwarzschild black holes. That's a black hole that's static. That's where, you know, the idea of the Schwarzschild radius comes from, usually also referred to as the event horizon. If you fall inside the Schwarzschild radius of a Schwarzschild black hole, then you won't escape again. We'll go through all that, but what I hope to do this year that I haven't managed to do because there's not been time in previous years is to also talk about rotating black holes. And that leads to a really fascinating effect called frame dragging, where the rotating black hole effectively kind of drags space-time around with it. And there's a couple of results we can derive there. And then finally, if there is time, I've got just a little bit on Hawking radiation as well. Everyone heard of Hawking radiation before? So that's very much post-Einstein work. It's work looking at whether or not black holes truly are black. Do they leak radiation to the outside universe? Hawking showed that they do. We now believe that black holes do indeed evaporate, but over a very, very long time scale. And some of the basic results about Hawking evaporation of black holes are derived at the end of Chapter 6. It's pretty simplistic. That's perhaps the only part where, largely because of gaps in my own knowledge, I've had to fall short of giving you the full gory treatment, because, you know, that's really far, far beyond what anyone at undergraduate level could be expected to cover. But all the other stuff you're doing, you know, there's no corners being cut. Chapter 7, could I ask how many people are doing the cosmology course this year as well, or have done it in the past? Right, so quite a lot. There's some results in the cosmology course which draw upon GR, but because that cosmology course is an H-level course, then they can't be derived or proved within the cosmology course, and therefore I've put them in this chapter instead. Specifically, it's to do with the idea of the cosmological principle, which says that the universe on large scales is isotropic and homogeneous. Well, that's what people learn in the first year cosmology course. What I want to do in Chapter 7 is show how that follows from GR ideas, essentially what's the GR version of the cosmological principle, and what does it predict for the form of the space-time metric. It turns out to be the Robertson-Walker metric, which is used then to derive things like the Friedman model, which describes the evolution of the universe. And within that same framework, and we can talk, this will be in the very final lecture, so I hope there's time, we'll talk about how in Einstein's early work he didn't include expansion, because nobody thought the universe was expanding, And in order to make the universe static, he introduced a cosmological constant, which we now think, although with a different value from the one that Einstein assumed, is very much back in vogue. And we now call it dark energy, but nobody really knows what it is yet. So I can show you in that final section how that fitted in to Einstein's original formulation. All right. So if anybody wants to walk out now, now's your chance if the description of the seven chapters isn't what you were expecting. But I hope it will be. As I said, chapter one is a chance for you to see what I regard as the key ideas and what notation I've used and where, if anywhere, that differs from Norman's. But we'll skip through that. But I do encourage you to read it yourself by way of a kind of refresher of the things that hopefully you're bringing with you from GRG1. By the way, there's, I think, how many did I write in the end? I think there's 5 example sheets, or maybe 6 example sheets. There's loads of examples. I'll put those on Moodle within the next week or so. So there's plenty to keep you busy in that regard. All right, so let's begin by talking about some things that actually do overlap with some parts of Norman's notes. I don't know how long he will have spent talking about these issues, but I believe they're lurking there in Norman's notes somewhere. The final section of Norman's notes, he maybe made a bit of a song and dance about this, but that was finally when he got to talk about some physics. Well, at least temporarily, we're going to go back to just talking about math, but we're just going to take the mathematical ideas you've already been introduced to and look at how we can simplify things a bit. And then we're going to use that simplified form of the maths when we go back to look at some physics problems again. So the chief way in which we can simplify our lives is by considering orthogonal metrics. So remember that the metric is a 0-2 tensor that effectively describes the curvature of space. I mean, strictly speaking, we introduced the Riemann-Christoffel or Riemann tensor to describe the curvature, but that's built out of the metric and its derivatives. And the metric as a 0-2 tensor in four-dimensional space-time has got 16 components. But because it's a symmetric tensor, that straight away reduces it to only 10. And what we'd really like to do is to reduce it a bit more. So if the metric's orthogonal, then we can do so. Because an orthogonal metric is one in which the metric components are 0 unless alpha equals beta. So insofar as you can think of the metric tensor as a matrix, and I think some of Norman's notes do that, you know, he'll write it as a 4x4 matrix, what we're really saying is that it's a diagonal matrix, because all the diagonal elements are 0. So that simplifies life a lot. It means that the metric is now described by only 4 terms. Now, the metric of special relativity is also one such metric. It's orthogonal, because it's just minus 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1. It's the metric I had in the first 2 pages. But in general relativity, you're not guaranteed to have an orthogonal metric. But if you choose your coordinate system so that it is orthogonal, then that simplifies life a great deal. So there's no cross terms in the expression for the interval. Oops, need to be careful with skipping pages in Acrobat. Sometimes when you get to the bottom of a page, it just goes ahead without me wishing to. Now, I've said there the components of a metric will not be orthogonal in any coordinate system. And then I go through a little proof of that. This is the sort of algebra that I would like you to be pretty comfortable with as you go through this course, because we'll be using these kind of ideas a lot. So let's just take a look at it now. So let's say that G, alpha, beta are the metric components in a particular coordinate system. Let's see. And they're orthogonal. So that means G, alpha, beta is 0 if alpha doesn't equal beta. And now we introduce another coordinate system, a dashed coordinate system. And I've denoted the components of the metric in the new coordinate system by the prime. G dash mu nu. Now G is a 0-2 tensor, so the transformation law for those metric components can be written as equation 2.3. So dx alpha by dx prime mu, dx beta by dx prime nu is just a set of functions that tell us how to transform the components of the metric from the undashed coordinate system to the dashed coordinate system. And the sort of example that you should always think of is something like going from Cartesian coordinates to polar coordinates, in which case the dx alphas by dx prime mu's would be things like sine theta and cos theta and so on, or r sine theta, r cos theta. So equation 2.1, the orthogonal condition, says that g prime mu nu, if we write that out, it's going to be equal to the expression you see in equation 2.4. Now where that's coming from is that 2.3 is a summation, it's the Einstein summation convention. Okay? So the g dash mu nu component is the sum over 16 components, because alpha varies from 0, 1, 2 and 3, and so too does beta. But because it's an orthogonal metric, then all of those terms are 0 unless alpha equals beta. So I've just now got a sum over alpha. Okay, so I've reduced it to only 4. But that still allows the possibility that g prime mu nu could be different from 0 even if mu doesn't equal nu. It doesn't force g prime mu nu to be 0 if mu doesn't equal nu. Okay, so it works in one coordinate system but not necessarily in another. In fact, we'll see an example of that in the chapter on black holes. We'll introduce a coordinate transformation that takes an orthogonal metric and turns it into a metric which isn't orthogonal, but actually, in that particular instance, is still a good transformation to do because it makes it easy to solve the problem that we'll be looking at in chapter 6. So most of the time orthogonal metrics are a good thing because they reduce the number of metric components, but every now and again there can be circumstances where having a non-orthogonal metric is actually okay. But if it is orthogonal in a particular choice of coordinate system, then it does at least mean that you've got fewer components to worry about. Now, what does it really mean to say that a metric's orthogonal? It's tied up with questions to do with the basis vectors. We're accustomed to thinking of basis vectors in Cartesian space as just, you know, I, j, and k. They're often labelled as. It's a unit vector in the x direction, the y direction, and the z direction, respectively. But in a general curved space-time, there's no reason why we have to use basis vectors which are orthogonal or orthonormal if we want them to be of unit length. So we often choose a coordinate basis with such a property, but we don't have to. And if you choose a coordinate system that's got basis vectors E sub I, and then you take two vectors A and B, so these are contravariant tensors, contravariant vectors are 1-0 tensors. So we can write the vector A as a set of components with upper indices AI multiplied by the basis vectors E sub I and then summed. The same for B. And then we write down what the scalar product is. So the scalar product in those terms is going to be AI times BJ times EI dot EJ. But if you look back to GRG1, well, I can't direct you to where it is explicitly in Norman's notes, but in my chapter 1, where I summarise the key results of GRG1, you'll see in there an expression for the scalar product, which is, because the scalar product is basically the contraction of A and B with the metric. So you can also write that as AIBJ times GIJ and then summed over I and J. So what that means is that GIJ has to equal the scalar product of the two basis vectors. So GIJ will be 0 if and only if the basis vectors are orthogonal. So we'll see much later, as I mentioned in the chapter in black holes, that there are coordinate systems in which you wind up with some off diagonal terms in the metric which correspond to non-orthogonal basis vectors. But for almost all of this course, we're going to stick with orthogonal metrics, and it really does make our life easier, because take for example converting from upper to lower indices, or the other way around. The contravariant components for an orthogonal metric, so we've generally thought about the metric as a 0-2 tensor, but there's no reason in principle why we can't write it with upper indices, convert it into a 2-0 tensor or even a 1-1 tensor. So how would we do that? Well, the key result that we use is this relation, is that G alpha beta with upper indices multiplied and then contracted with the metric with lower indices, so that's G alpha gamma. Because the alpha appears above and below, then it's a sum, and we know that that is equal to delta beta gamma. Delta is the Kronecker delta. It's equal to 1 if beta and gamma are the same, and it's 0 otherwise. Okay, but if G alpha gamma is a set of orthogonal metric components, then that means that G alpha gamma is going to be 0 unless alpha equals gamma. So equation 2.8 can be rewritten as G gamma beta times G gamma gamma. That has to equal the Kronecker delta, which means in fact that G gamma beta will be 0 if gamma and beta are different, because that's what the Kronecker delta equals in that case. But if gamma and beta are the same, then it's G gamma gamma upper indices times G gamma gamma lower indices equals 1, or G gamma gamma with upper indices is just 1 over G gamma gamma with lower indices. Again, this isn't, you know, wildly surprising if you think of the tensor G as a matrix, because let's say the problem you might have met before would be one of finding the eigenvalues of a matrix. If the matrix is diagonal, then the eigenvalues of the inverse are just 1 over the eigenvalues of the original matrix. So, you know, you can exploit a lot of the ideas that are there in your linear algebra and apply them here as well. I say it'll take us a lecture or two to get going in this, because we'll use a number of these key results very soon to help us derive, you know, things which are astrophysically interesting, but for the moment it's really just, you know, part of our kind of mathematical toolbox. Christoffel symbols for an orthogonal metric. So again, I'm virtually certain that Norman's got these somewhere in his notes, but you might not have spent very long on it. Remember the Christoffel symbols, well, what are they? If you look back at my chapter 1, you'll see how I choose to summarise them. I describe them, I suppose, as functions that tell you how the basis vectors transform when you move from one place to another in a curved space-time. Now, if you're in Cartesian coordinates, in flat space, the basis vectors are the same everywhere. So the Christoffel symbols are zero everywhere, because the basis vectors don't change as you move around. But if you're in curved space-time, or actually if you're in flat space but in polar coordinates, then you still need to change your basis vectors as you move around. Therefore, the Christoffel symbols are non-zero. But the Christoffel symbols for an orthogonal metric are at least a wee bit easier to write down. And the expressions that you see here are what you get when you take the expression for the Christoffel symbols, which I'm going to write out here. So gamma of mu alpha beta, we can write that as G mu sigma over 2 times G, alpha sigma comma beta plus G beta sigma comma alpha minus G alpha beta comma sigma. Now, I'm not asking anyone to say that they could have derived that on the spot or anything, but do you vaguely recognise that from Norman's course? Okay, now what I'll do for next lecture is I'll bring along a wee handout which I wrote, which is my kind of crib sheet for remembering where to put the indices in that expression. I've got one for the Christoffel symbols, I've also got one for the Riemann-Christoffel tensor, which is expressed in terms of the Christoffel symbols and its derivatives. You know, it's not exactly something you can use as a party trick, but it is potentially something that could save you a bit of time when you're going through a question in the exam. Instead of sitting there, oh God, you know, where do the symbols go? Don't just memorise it parrot fashion, but understand that there's a logical reason why the symbols have to go in certain places, and that's what the wee handout will describe. So all we've done to get these equations is we've taken this general form for the Christoffel symbols, and we've said, if we've got an orthogonal metric, how does that expression simplify? Well, it does, and it gives you equations 212. And the first example sheet encourages you to try this for yourself and to see whether you can derive the equations in 212. Okay? The real reason why we want orthogonal metrics and we want expressions for the Christoffel symbols is so that we can get our hands on the geodesic equation, because the geodesic equation is the thing we have to solve to tell us the trajectories that particles will follow or that photons will follow, and that's when we can start to do some proper physics. So the geodesic equation for an orthogonal metric also takes a slightly simpler form than the one that you may have met in Norman's course. Now, what you may have encountered in Norman's course, if he gave you it in component form, would perhaps have been this. D2 x mu by d tau squared plus gamma mu alpha beta dx alpha by d tau dx beta by d tau equals zero. Again, does that look vaguely familiar? Okay, so there's another way to write the geodesic differential equation, and it involves replacing the Christoffel symbols in here, in this form of the geodesic differential equation, by the expression for the Christoffel symbols in terms of the metric and its derivatives, but then using the fact that the metric being orthogonal is zero unless the indices of the metric are both equal. And what it all reduces to is equation 213. So equation 213 is true for any metric. It doesn't have to be orthogonal. It reduces a wee bit more to 214 if the metric's orthogonal. And that's on the second example sheet. I mean, this isn't something I'm going to examine you on. However, it's important that you know the result, because we're going to use this form of the geodesic equation when we derive and explore the Schwarzschild metric in the next chapter. So I would highly recommend that you have a look at the examples. In fact, really, the sooner rather than later. All right. Okay. Now, geometrized units, what's that all about? In Norman's half of the course, did he just set the speed of light equal to 1? Can anyone remember? It may not really have come up, but I mean, where you would most likely see this, when you derive Einstein's equations at the end, did they look something like this? G mu nu, that's the Einstein tensor, equal to just a constant times T mu nu. Well, the constant K, you can derive K, I think this is right at the very end of Norman's notes, by saying that in the weak field limit, you've got to get back just Newtonian gravity. So K turns out to be equal to 8 pi G over C to the fourth. But quite often, in GR textbooks, people will just set C equal to 1. In fact, very often people also set G equal to 1, and that's what I'm going to do here. The justification for setting C equal to 1 is that what you're kind of basically doing then is you're measuring time in units of length. So 1 second is how far light would travel in a second, or 3 × 10⁸ meters. And in the same way, you can also measure mass in units of length. Because G, which is 6.673, if I remembered rightly, the third decimal place, × 10⁻¹⁰ newtons meter squared per kilogram. Maybe that should be per kilogram cubed. Oh, I hate trying to work equations out on the spot. I'll check that. If I've got a typo there, then I'll fix it for next week. Anyway, the newtons are composite. Oh, no, I know where I'm getting it from. It's because I've written it as newtons there, but if I put 1 newton as 1 kilogram meter per second squared, then I get G. That's more like it. So I get meters cubed. I knew there was a cube in there somewhere. Meters cubed, kilograms to the minus 1, seconds to the minus 2. So the unit of time we can replace by a unit of length, so it's the distance that light would travel in a second. So that gives us 7.41 × 10⁻²⁸ meters per kilogram. So if we set G equal to 1, what we're effectively doing then is measuring mass in units of length. We're saying that 1 kilogram is equivalent to 7.41 × 10⁻²⁸ meters. And you might ask yourself, well, what's the point of that? What does that really mean? What it represents, basically, is what the Schwarzschild radius would be of 1 kilogram. So if you took a 1 kilogram bag of sugar and said, how small would you have to shrink it to be before that bag of sugar became a black hole, then it would be of order 7 × 10⁻²⁸ meters. So I don't think you really need to worry. And interestingly, of course, ideas like this have been in the media, although, as ever, very poorly presented by the media, with all the concern about primordial black holes being produced by the LHC gobbling up the entire universe. The masses of such black holes is sufficiently small that I don't think any of us need to be too concerned. Okay? So, by and large, we'll just set G equal to 1. We won't bother with being explicit about physical units. Sometimes we will, but we'll use these geometrized units. Right, so there's maybe just time to do a little bit more before we stop for today. I want to talk, just to wind things up then, about spherically symmetric metrics. Metrics which are which have spherical symmetry, and what their general form will be. What do we mean by a spherically symmetric solution? Well, it's really the idea in the box which is important. A space-time is spherically symmetric if every point on the space-time lies on a 2D surface which can be represented as a two-dimensional sphere. Okay? In Flat-Minkowski space-time, what we do is we change our variables to give what you see in equation 215. Instead of dx, dy, and dz, we have dr, d theta, and d phi. And the surfaces of constant r and t, so that would mean dt is 0 and dr is 0, are then just surfaces that correspond to the geometry of a two-dimensional sphere with fixed radius r, and then theta and phi varying over the surface of the sphere. So that is what we employ as our general definition of what we mean by a surface that's spherically symmetric. It means that whichever point we choose to be at, we can represent the metric such that our space-time takes the form of this 2D surface for fixed r and fixed t. And then the next little bit I'm not going to read out in detail, it's just coming up with a way to kind of extend those ideas where we don't fix r and t, but we just say that we're at some r and t, we specify those as some function f, and we now take that function and just use that to define what our radial coordinate is. Essentially what I'm saying is that you can slice up the space, the three-dimensional space, any way you like, one of the big important things about GR is that the equations of physics have to hold in any coordinate system. So if you want to choose a weird coordinate system, you're perfectly at liberty to. Doesn't really make a lot of sense, but you can. So there's nothing to stop you having a system where at one value of r, your theta and phi origin points in some direction, and then at the next value of r, if you consider a series of concentric spheres, that your origin of theta and phi lies in a wholly different direction. Imagine, you know, you've got a series of these concentric spheres and you give the whole thing a shake. The origins are going to shift around. But it kind of makes sense to line all the origins up. And that's all we're really doing there. So you're lining up the origins of our two sphere coordinate systems, each with their own theta and phi, so that they're all aligned, and then this function f can then play the role of your radial coordinate. Okay, and spherical symmetry also requires that any radial path, that's where you're varying r but you're keeping all the other components fixed, has to be orthogonal to these 2D spheres. Otherwise you'd have a preferred direction, but you've lined up all your coordinate systems, and then theta and phi vary as you move along, well, rather they don't vary as you move along a radial path, because that's really what makes a radial. So all of this means, if you you can read this more carefully for yourself, that what you wind up with is some of the terms in the expression for ds squared dropping out, and just in equation 221 we discussed further how that means you can get rid of some more terms. So in general, a spherically symmetric spacetime, takes the form, if I can somehow manage to get the page to stop, of equation 222. So you've got some function of dt squared, gtt is the coefficient of that. You've got a dr squared term. You've got the familiar r squared d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared that we saw in special relativity as well. So the Minkowski metric expressed in polar coordinates. But we've still got this term gtr. So we could have a term, a cross term involving dr and dt, and still have a spherically symmetric spacetime. But it wouldn't be static. If we want the spacetime also to be static, then that means that all the metric components have to be independent of t. Okay? Actually, strictly speaking, there's another thing you could have, which is a stationary metric, but we won't consider that here. If we want a static metric, which is an even stronger condition, then all the metric components have to be independent of t. So that means that that other term that sort of messes up the symmetry of our expression of 222, gtr, well, that has to be zero as well. You can't have a metric component that depends on t. So gtr winds up being zero as well. So an orthogonal, spherically symmetric, static metric takes this form, and what we've done is we've just replaced the two expressions that were in the previous slide by functions e to the nu and e to the lambda. Okay, I've just kind of pulled those out of thin air, but we'll see in the next couple of lectures why I did so, because they'll play a crucial role in deriving the Schwarzschild metric. Basically, our task when we derive the Schwarzschild metric is to work out what that function is and what that function is. If we just set them both equal to 1, then what we've got is Minkowski spacetime, but expressed in polar coordinates. But they're not equal to 1, and we'll see why when we derive the Schwarzschild metric in a lecture or two. Okay, so the very final bit, I know we're just a bit out of time, of this chapter is to derive the Christoffel symbols for a static, spherically symmetric spacetime. Now this is all worked through in the example sheets, but I don't want to leave absolutely everything for you to do yourself, so what I'll do at the start of Friday's lecture is I'll go through one of these examples to show you how these results appear, you know, where they come from. Okay? And then with these results for the Christoffel symbols, it's a matter of doing a bit of bit more algebra to come up with the what we call the Ricci tensor. Now if you look back at past paper questions, you'll see that any time I've set a question to do with the Schwarzschild metric, I've always given you the Ricci tensor components. So you don't need to memorise these, but it makes a lot of sense to kind of understand where they come from, so that when you're confronted with them on the exam paper, if the question requires you to use them, you don't spend the first 5 minutes trying to sort of remember what the terms mean. Okay? So I'll begin the next lecture by going through one of the earlier examples and just sort of letting you see roughly how you do this, although it's explained in detail in example sheet 2. And then we'll be all set to begin the derivation of the Schwarzschild metric. Okay? So, a sensor note round, which I hope everybody's got, and I did it via the A345 forum. I don't know whether Declan's got everyone signed up. I guess since you're here today, the chances are you did get it, but it's to remind you that there isn't a lecture at 2 o'clock on Friday. I've got to be in Edinburgh in the morning, and I was a bit worried I wouldn't get back in time. So, second lecture's at 3 o'clock, 3 till 4 on Friday, and we'll see you then. Thank you.